wait for El Camino. The Breaking Bad movie is over, but we're just getting started breaking it down on this special movie podcast. And now here are the two guys that are the Badger and Skinny Pete of podcasting. I am Rob Sister here with Antonio Mazzara. Antonio, how are you?
I'm fine. Happy to be the Badger in this scenario. Happy to be the Badger. I'm happy also not to be the Todd in this scenario, who is the opposite of skinny, I think, at this point.
Yeah. Well, I don't remember Todd being so bloated in the original timeline.
No, look, the Breaking Bad, this movie was shot quickly and in secret, not something that was a big plan. I think Jesse Plemons is involved in other roles which require him to have a different look, and so here we are.
Not the roles that Saul Goodman works on these days, right?
No, and not the roles that they serve up at O'Charlie's. Not a sponsor of this podcast.
Antonio, so nice to get to chat with you about the El Camino movie.
I'm excited. I'm much happier to be talking to you about the El Camino movie than an actual El Camino, which I don't know about you, Rob. It's never been on my list to own El Camino. Are you an El Camino guy? Did you grow up around El Caminos?
Definitely not. Definitely not. I couldn't pick an El Camino out of a lineup.
Oh, believe me, I can. They where I grew up, they were definitely a thing. And it's like a hybrid between a pickup truck and a station wagon. I mean, I don't even know what the appeal is, but Todd sure liked it, and it definitely played a prominent role in this movie, such that you can understand why it was titled El Camino.
Yeah.
But yeah, not an El Camino guy.
If you have Todd's lifestyle, El Camino is a great car. Perfect.
Definitely.
For Todd. Todd is who they were thinking of. You know, there's been some unusual cars in the Breaking Bad universe. Don't forget, Walter White used to drive a Pontiac Aztec.
Exactly. We talked a little bit about when we podcasted, you and I here at Post Show Recaps, about Breaking Bad, and we podcast about Better Call Saul, that Pontiac Aztec was in some ways representative of Walter White's soul. It became beaten up and brutalized. So if that's true, if cars are souls, Todd is an El Camino man through and through, always in need of a car where you can just stash a housekeeper's body in the back along with your reek pet that you're keeping.
Right. Right. All right. So we're going to talk through the El Camino movie and give you our thoughts on this. I've tried to sort of stay in my own bubble with my thoughts on this. I haven't done a lot of research into the reaction to it.
I haven't really either. I don't know, specifically among the fandom. I've seen one or two critical reactions, but I haven't seen how fans are responding to it. And I think that's key for this project, because to me, it's clearly a love letter to fans of Breaking Bad. A lot of fun Easter eggs that we can talk about and get into without ultimately spoiling everything that will happen, which we will do as well. But this is a movie that could have really screwed up a lot of what people assigned value to the ending of Breaking Bad. It could have changed significantly the way we felt about characters or where they ended up. Instead of doing that, I think it just put us in a position where the show and the movie got to execute the way the show did, with a lot of capers and some great shots. We got to revisit some of our favorite characters, and we ended in a place I think most of us thought Breaking Bad could have ended in. So all in all, I think a very successful project.
So just a quick heads up before we get to talking about the movie. Antonio, I know you are back busy podcasting on a number of shows, including Mr. Robot for the final season.
I am. Here at Post Show Recaps, Josh Wigler and I have podcasted about nearly every episode of Mr. Robot through its four-season run. It is entering its fourth season. Season two, or episode two, will air the Sunday night, the weekend of this El Camino movie. So we're really looking forward to that, and we will be podcasting about every episode of season four as we do that. It's a show that I think really fits this podcasting model, where we can theorize and speculate and really break down individual scenes. We've had a lot of fun doing that over the course of the run, so you can definitely check those podcasts out if you're a fan of that show. You, I know, Rob and Josh podcasted at here at Post Show Recaps extensively about another show that ended its final season recently, and that was certainly fun to theorize and break down. How did that go for you? How was the end of Game of Thrones, Rob?
Not great. Hopefully they'll make a movie a couple of years later, and then they'll explain some of the other stuff that was going on. Maybe we'll see Arya in her own movie following the Game of Thrones finale.
El Camino del Rey, the King's Road. Yeah, that would be great. We probably will see Game of Thrones movies. Like, it seems like an inevitability. We saw this month a Downton Abbey movie was released. So this seems to be a model. You've got a successful TV show out there. People want hashtag content. Let's make a movie that's set in the TV show universe. And I think Breaking Bad certainly occupies that space really well and does itself a credit. So I think we're going to just see more of these things. It wouldn't surprise me to see Game of Thrones movie. What else is going on here at Post Show Recaps? Rob, I know Josh and Jessica Lease are podcasting about The Walking Dead, another one of your favorites.
Yeah, The Walking Dead into season 10. Yeah, the new season is back, and so is Jessica. And then now she's with Josh talking about The Walking Dead on Post Show Recaps. Plus, Josh and Mike are continuing to do the Lost rewatch as well. And Josh is going to wrap up Succession as well right now. So a lot going on over on Post Show Recaps.
Are you a Succession guy, Rob?
I think I would be, but I have not gotten into it yet.
I definitely recommend that you give it a chance. I don't know that there's a better show on TV right now in terms of doing what Succession does, in terms of you buying in to characters that you're like, why am I buying into what these people are doing? It's really high drama. It's sort of like Arrested Development meets Shakespeare. These families backstabbing each other and occupying this just a completely unlikable area, but you're still feeling bad for them. It's a really, really well done show. And anyone who's listening to this and is a fan of Breaking Bad would probably like checking it out. It's not for everybody because there really isn't anyone to root for on that show too much, but it is a really fascinating show. Definitely worth checking out.
Okay. Antonio, we now know that Jesse Pinkman is off to Alaska, courtesy of the idea from another one of our favorites, Mike Ehrmantraut.
Yeah, what do you think? Why do you think Mike Ehrmantraut was a fan of Alaska? He articulates it a little bit here, but is this something you think Mike Ehrmantraut grew up as a fan of Alaska? Is this something a life he wished he'd had lived? Is this something you think he speculated about when he was younger?
Are there a lot of minor league baseball operations in Alaska?
They do play that midnight baseball game there since the sun doesn't go down. Yeah, so maybe Mike's a fan of the midnight baseball.
Do they have any baseball?
Yeah, will my radio pick up anything from Juno? Yeah, that would be a good place for Mike. That was cool. It's good to see Jonathan Banks. Again, I just think the guy should stay out of the sun, but what are you going to do? You know, you can take Jonathan Banks out of the sun for only so long.
I have so many questions about the different flashbacks. Where are you able to, as somebody who has done, you know, a rewatch of Breaking Bad, can you place where that was in the timeline, that scene between Jesse and Mike?
I can't place it directly. What I would say generally is, based on what Jesse was articulating there about wanting to get out, I think it's probably somewhere in the early part of season 5 when Jesse is ready to retire because of everything that happened with Todd and with Drew Sharp, when a child was unfortunately a casualty of their meth train heist. Jesse was ready to get out of the drug game at that point. And that seems like around when this is happening because of his emotions and mentality. I would not place it earlier, and I don't think there's a way to really place it later. So I think it's around that point in season 5 when Jesse is articulating that he's ready to get out of the game. That makes sense. That said, the location, I believe, is a similar or the exact location where Mike ultimately meets his untimely demise at the hands of Walter White later on, a few episodes later in season 5. So this is Mike's meeting space that is fouled by Walter White later. And this is not a scene that I recall taking place in Breaking Bad. Yeah, so this is one of those ones they shot for this movie.
Were any of the flashbacks things that actually were lifted from Breaking Bad, like Jesse with Jane or any of the other pieces that we saw from the alternate flashbacks?
Not that I can think of. The scene with Walter White is definitely not, although you could put it in the episode where it would fit, and it would fit really well, to the point where Jesse's in his hotel room at the beginning of that scene trying to cool down. He's in a bathtub with ice, and he's got the air conditioning set all the way down, because that comes right after he and Walter were stuck out in the desert for several days and were worried they were never going to make it back because the Winnebago ran out of gas, or the battery died and they weren't able to get back. So that it fits directly into the timeline. And similarly with Jane, that's a flashback that's part of another flashback, I think. Like, we don't necessarily see some of those moments in the moment when she, I think that's, Jane is a big character in season two of Breaking Bad.
Sure.
We know what happens to her. In season three, there is a flashback to a trip she and Jesse took. And I think this is tacked on to that flashback. It is not part of the show proper. There were some other flashes, like Jesse being hit with a hose by the Nazis and some stuff like that, that maybe you could say were loosely tied, but I don't really think anything like that, these flashbacks were present in Breaking Bad.
Yeah. Okay. The flashbacks were important though. And if I was going to say, like, in terms of like the, what were the things that I enjoyed the most in the movie, I feel like that almost all of my favorite parts were things that were happening in the flashbacks.
That's interesting. Do you have any comprehension as to why that is? I would say for me, my biggest concern watching the movie the first time through is that, as I said earlier, maybe I was concerned about how it would end. I was concerned that they were going to ruin this ending for Jesse Pinkman, that he was going to be murdered and or arrested, or something really bad was going to happen to him as a result of what happened in the movie. And so my greatest concern throughout any of the new scenes was, okay, this is where it goes south for Jesse. Like, this is where it's going to go bad for Jesse. So of course the flashback scenes were happy. Like, they were like, okay, nothing bad can happen here. I know he's not going to die. I know Todd, when they're hiding this body in the desert, I know Todd's not going to, you know, shoot him, or he's not going to shoot Todd for what happened. So I think maybe it was the idea that there were no real stakes in those scenes that made them appealing for me. Is it similar for you?
I didn't think about it in terms of that there were no stakes. I just feel like that, you know, feral Jesse on the run just, you know, was not as interesting of a character for me, I guess, than some of the other colorful characters that we got to see through the flashbacks, with the exception of the scenes with Jesse and Robert Forrester. But other than that, you know, it was like a lot of Jesse Pinkman sneaking around.
It was. And that, of course, wordless sneaking or wordless capers are a huge part of the Breaking Bad universe. We saw a lot of that in this, obviously. These wordless scenes where Jesse's sneaking around or tearing down an apartment, much like Chuck on Better Call Saul, Rob. Mm-hmm. But this is right in their wheelhouse, like montages or sequences like this. But there was a lot of that, to be fair. And to be fair, he was on the run, so he would be sneaking around. But I think the real value in this film is in those flashbacks. It is in revisiting Breaking Bad. It is in seeing some of our favorite characters pop up again, and having those scenes really crackle and wondering what we maybe didn't see during the run of Breaking Bad. I was a little surprised we didn't get any Saul Goodman in this. Were you surprised we didn't get Bob Odenkirk or Saul Goodman?
Yeah, I was very surprised, considering that he's such an important figure in the universe now with Better Call Saul. I'm not sure exactly where we would have gotten him, because I think that, you know, he ends up going off to Omaha before Jesse ends up being captured. So I'm not sure exactly where we would have gotten that sort of flashback. Maybe if in terms of like setting everything up with Robert Forrester, but it would have been nice to see Saul.
Right. And I do wonder, and this is just kind of planting a flag in the Better Call Saul coverage that we do here. I do wonder if that is the sort of thing, for as far as a flashback goes, that fills in some details from the Breaking Bad timeline. If maybe they did decide to save anything like that with Saul Goodman and Jesse because they want to put it in Better Call Saul.
Yeah.
So that's something I wondered about, because generally speaking, in Better Call Saul with this most recent season, we did find our way into the Breaking Bad timeline. We saw a scene like this that was in terms of seeing a scene that would have happened contemporaneously with Breaking Bad that we didn't see during the run of Breaking Bad. We saw a scene like that with Saul Goodman in the last season of Better Call Saul. So it seems like a timeline they are willing to visit in that regard on Better Call Saul. And if that's the case, then I think they want to leave open the ability to do that with Jesse. And I do wonder if maybe they shot a couple of those to be used in Better Call Saul. all, since we didn't see anything like that here. Yeah. That would have been the time to do it. You had Aaron Paul.
Yeah.
You had him in New Mexico. You had him with your crew. Like, that would have been a good time to do it for sure.
Do you think that the lack of Saul Goodman has anything to do with AMC and this is a show on their network? I mean, it does seem weird that you have a show that's an AMC franchise, but then you're doing a movie for the franchise on Netflix. Is there any sort of complications there?
That's a good question. The creative DNA, I'm sure, not in terms of the money men, but in terms of Peter Gould and Vince Gilligan, the people who make the shows Better Call Saul and Breaking Bad. I know Vince Gilligan went to Peter Gould as part of them making this movie and said, hey, I don't want anything I do here to screw up what you guys are doing creatively. So let's have a chat about what I want to do in this movie and make sure it doesn't screw up what you want to do with where you take Better Call Saul. Because, of course, in Better Call Saul, you also have a timeline that takes place after the events of Breaking Bad, much like this film, that shows what Bob Odenkirk, what Saul is up to. You pointed out he's in Omaha, or he's fled, and you see some of those scenes in Better Call Saul at the beginning of every season, him as Gene, his new identity, what he's up to. And so one of the things I think they didn't want to do was screw up wherever that might be going. So I know they talked about that on that level, but as far as the money goes, I don't know if AMC was like, I'm sure AMC would have wanted that character to show up. Anything Breaking Bad that's popular and that does well, even if it's on another platform, can only be good for Better Call Saul. Mm-hmm. The more people that watch Breaking Bad on Netflix, the more people will watch Better Call Saul on AMC, theoretically. So I don't think they would have had too much of a problem with that.
Okay. The other big news from the weekend with the El Camino release is the death of Robert Forster. This was, the day that the movie ended up coming out was the day that Robert Forster ended up passing away.
I'd like to believe that Robert Forster passed away, but another identity was taken, and the actor Robert Forster is now living another life somewhere in another plane, happily leaving behind that role. Unfortunately, we did lose Robert Forster. Great send-off, I'd say. This is probably more so than just about anything in terms of the actual value of this project. For him to get what he got and to have the fun that he had in this final, I'm not sure if it's going to be his final work, but certainly the work that aired contemporaneously with his passing. It's great. It's really a great thing to see him in this role, to see it have such a big part in this film, even though it does time out in a very unfortunate way because of what happened. Would that on the weekend of my demise, there's a movie that comes out with me where I have such a great role and people are given the opportunity to remark upon how great I am in the context of something I was doing in the moment, not just because I died. So, and I don't want to talk about myself dying anymore. So I'm going to end there.
Okay. Antonio, tell me if this is too hot of a take that Robert Forster's character, Ed, is he the biggest winner of the Breaking Bad universe?
That is interesting. Let's think about how much money he probably has and how little he lost, right? Because you could talk about how much money that Walter Jr. might end up with because of the events at the end of Breaking Bad, how Walt schemed to get him in the position where he would end up with some money. I don't know about Kaylee Ehrmantraut. She did lose her grandpa. She might get some money. She might not. But clearly Robert Forster got a boatload of cash, has no ties to any of this. Mm-hmm. And theoretically, no real moral, he doesn't really seem all that upset about his role in any of it. So
no.
he's a very, very, very big winner for sure.
He doesn't ask a lot of questions. He ends up, by my calculations, if we get the price at $125K, then he got Jesse twice, Walter White, and Saul Goodman. So he's up to at least $500K tax-free.
$500K tax-free. And by the way, this is a service that he doesn't just run for Saul Goodman, right? So how many people did he run it for with? I don't know, but he's made a lot of money for sure.
Yeah, but he's still keeping the vacuum business. That's why he can afford to, look at that lady's vacuum and not charge her any fees to do that. So he's doing a good service in Albuquerque.
Yeah, and although he's kind of talking his way out of business, right? He's basically saying, like, yeah, you don't need to buy a new vacuum. You want to bring your old one.
This is his side business. This is his hobby, is tinkering around with vacuums.
Yeah, so this is an easy way to have that supported. I don't know what happens with, I mean, I'm trying to think about who else ends up with a huge chunk of money here without much to lose. And I mean, Skinny Pete and Badger probably ended up with a good amount of money as a result of everything that happened. But I don't know how much, and I don't know where it went, and I don't know how much of that they might have left. And mm-hmm. I also don't know how much they might have got jammed up by the cops in the aftermath of what happened. So Robert Forster, I don't think it's that hot of a take. He may be the ultimate winner.
The big winner. Okay. Jesse Pinkman, in terms of what we learned in the El Camino movie, that was Jesse able to find any redemption through this movie? I mean, there were a couple of themes that were touched on about where Mike in the beginning talked about, you know, the one thing you can never do is put things right. You can get a clean start, but you can never put things right. That was the thing that Mike wanted to make sure Jesse knew. And then we had a little bit out of left field at the end of the movie where Jane was talking about, you know, don't just go where the universe takes you. You want to seek out your own destiny. Where do we think Jesse goes from here?
The sky is the limit, really, in many
respects.
Back
to college?
To go get a business degree, maybe.
Not a GED.
Not a GED. Listen, he graduated high school, Rob. How dare you? You were on that stage. Yeah, maybe back to college. I don't know what Alaska's colleges are like up there. I know there's at least probably the University of Alaska, right? So I don't know if that's something that he wants to do. He has a nice little nest egg,
I think. I think so, though, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's not huge. I mean, this is...
Does Jesse have any money left, or did he take the money from the guys that he shot?
Yeah, I think he's got that money. I think he's got the money from the guys that he shot, because whatever was in Todd's fridge was probably, if Jesse took a third of it, or even if he took half of it, he's got at least $150K, minus $1,800, of course, or maybe a little bit more. So that's a nice chunk. That's a good little nest egg to get started with. And as far as redemption goes, a lot of the film was about, I think, him trying to set things right before he left town. So he did get direct revenge on the welding guys who welded up the system that made him a dog on a leash, essentially. We saw that great shootout where he was able to exact revenge. He sort of apologized to his parents. I think as far as the notes he could have left things on with his parents, that was a decent one. You can debate whether he put his dad in the crosshairs with shell casings or anything that might have been left at the scene.
Can we talk about the thing with the parents? Because I thought that Jesse kind of did his parents dirty, where he called them up, right? And he said, hey, meet me at the park. I'm going to, you know, come pick me up so I could turn myself in, right? And then when they went out, he broke into their house and took his dad's guns.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of messed up.
Especially since he then used those guns. Presumably, dad's fingerprints are on the shell casings that would have been spent onto the ground and probably would still be recoverable. I mean, I don't know if his dad's going to have any more legal problems. The cops were watching his parents, as we saw when he pulled away. But I do think that his response to them was a little genuine. I mean, there's the moment where he goes into their apartment or their house and he sees that they left in such a hurry to go help him that they left the water running. Mm-hmm. And even though there is that last little stab of the knife where the safe code is his brother's birthday and not his, I think he recognizes that his parents do have whatever level of care they're able to give. They have their own problems and they're not perfect by any stretch. But he tells them, I mean, he says the sort of thing to them that they probably needed to hear, which is, it's not your fault. Don't blame yourselves for anything I did. I did it on my own. As far as that goes, that's a pretty good last thing to say to them. It certainly isn't going to keep them up at night. It is, I think, good closure in that moment. And so there is that level of closure. He leaves his friends on a good note. He gets a really good moment with Skinny Pete.
Great send off for Skinny Pete. Skinny Pete, one of the MVPs.
Skinny MVP, exactly. No doubt.
Like, what a guy.
Needs
what a great
friend.
Guy.
I know. Everybody needs a friend like that. He'll give him that, give you the hat off his head along with his car, and he'll take the heat for you. He'll help you on your way out. He'll convince your goof ass friend Badger to play a role.
Like, he was so clutch. He really, he was like right off the top of his head. Okay, you do this, you do this, you do this. I mean, Skinny P was ready to go.
And that is, I think, in it's there with his character throughout the course of Breaking Bad. If you go back and you look at what Skinny P did for Jesse, and you look at the fact that we always had these hints that there was more to Skinny P than just being the guy who he looks like. We see him playing like classical piano at one point. And he's always there for Jesse when Jesse's at his lowest moment. Skinny P is right there. So it was very fitting and I think appropriate and a really great note to have Skinny P play the role he played. He and Badger also brought a lot of comic relief. They're always very funny. Their conversation, Rob, about all the Skinny P's inability to play the video game yeah. and his poor abilities as a driver, that was very funny. So it was great to see those guys. Just throughout this film, there are a lot of moments like that where you're like, I didn't think we'd get a cameo from X, and it worked. It worked really well. I mean, Robert Forster, the showdown he has with Jesse was also really, really funny, where he calls the police and Jesse is just sure that he didn't call the police, and the Robert Forster's like, gotta love that response time.
Yeah. Yeah, that was really great. Then he gives the other description to the police officers when they come through.
Very tall guy, yeah.
Yeah, insect tattoo.
Right over his eyebrow, yeah.
Over his eyes. So that was fun. Antonio, if somebody came into this, though, as somebody who has, not seen a lot of Breaking Bad, was there a lot to get out of this if you were sort of a Breaking Bad casual?
Definitely. I think so. I mean, not as much. I mean, because what you've got ultimately, you're right that it has a lot more reward for people who were closely paying attention to Breaking Bad. If you were Breaking Bad casual, though, what you got was a movie that was very tense. They had a lot of those sneaking around kind of moments that had a lot of capers. It probably could have been about 40 minutes shorter if you were a casual mm-hmm. and you didn't need to see Jesse and Todd tripping the life fantastic through the desert as they went to bury a housekeeper and say some kind words over her hastily dug grave. But overall, I think there was a lot of thrill in this, a lot of running from the police, hiding from the police, hiding behind counters, shootouts with welders after the strippers left. I mean, there was a lot of grist there. There was a lot to chew on. That was fun, even if you didn't get the love letters. But certainly, I think for the deeper cut fans of Breaking Bad, there's going to be more value in this.
Can we dig in on Todd a little bit? Because I think that on my rewatch of this, I enjoyed all of the Todd parts the most.
I liked everything in the Todd, except for the memento he kept from Drew Sharp. We don't need that. Nobody needs that.
The tarantula.
We don't need that. Let's not say the word. It's fine. That's not on my Twitter likes. So let's just put it that way.
In that you are not a spider guy?
Yeah, correct. Okay. And to the point that, it just, I don't need to see it in the show.
I thought you were affected by Drew Sharp.
Well, more so by the spider than Drew Sharp. Yeah, that's the kind of person I am, Rob. The fact that he kept that as a memento, but then was treating it as a pet. He's a psycho. The fact that he had a snow globe in his apartment that looked to be him and Lydia, like a woman sitting on a teacup and like a little version of Todd in the snow globe. Psycho. The fact that he choked his housekeeper out with his belt because she found his encyclopedia of money where it was the M. What was she looking up? Mexico? Psycho. Like this guy, and he's trying to eat soup. He put the belt back on.
Yeah.
He needed that belt. He needed that belt, by the way. No, he just needed it. No offense to Todd, but this guy's nuts. And there were a lot of those great character notes about Todd just strewn throughout the scenes here, that he is just so casual about all this insanity, that he keeps trophies from murders, that he made a snow globe of him and a woman that he had a crush on that he met a few times. Like this is a really, really sick, crazy person. And what did you think was going to happen with he and Jesse? I mean, I wasn't surprised when the camera panned down and there was a body there based on how Jesse had reacted. But before that, did you think we were going in a different direction with this? like maybe a Pulp Fiction basement kind of direction, or
I have to say that did not cross my mind. The relationship between Todd and Jesse, though, I don't recall the reekification of Jesse. Was this a thing in Breaking Bad, or did this end up getting sort of established in El Camino?
Well, there was enough between Todd and Jesse in Breaking Bad for there to be, I think, a lot more that they could explore in El Camino. Todd is the one who in Ozymandias says to Uncle Jack, as Uncle Jack is about to take Jesse's life, oh, wait a minute. Like, I know this guy. We have a past. He probably said some things to the feds. Like, maybe we should take him back and we can get something more out of him. I can do this. Believe me, I know what I'm doing. And so he's the one who ultimately gets Jesse's life spared. You question his motivation in that moment. Was he looking for a friend? Was he looking for a pet? He treats Jesse like a pet in this movie. He like licks his hand and he says, I want to keep you cleaner from now on. You really need to focus on that. Yeah. And yeah, the reekification is a great word, because when Jesse does get the gun from the glove box, he's like, I'm going to get you some pizza. What kind of pizza do you want, buddy? And Jesse just like cries as he says pepperoni. Like, it's so brutal. Mm-hmm. And you're almost given to wonder, much in the way Ramsey Bolton did he leave that gun in the glove box so that Jesse would get hope and then just show his dominance over him? With this Todd guy, you just can't tell what level there is. One thing that was there in Breaking Bad that is hanging over all of this is that Jesse, Andrea, Jesse's girlfriend, the mother of Brock, the little boy who Jesse cared so much for and who he left the letter for at the end of the movie, Andrea did get murdered by Todd and by the Nazis as a result of Jesse's trying to escape from their control. So there is a lot of that mind control going on, where Jesse feels like, these guys, if I screw up, will kill anyone close to me, including this very guy, Todd. And of course, Jesse's the one who kills Todd at the end of Breaking Bad by choking him out. So there is a lot I think they wanted to fill in there, because there was a story between the two of them. So I do think that it does fit. As far as the reekification goes, though, you just really had the murder of Andrea as the big thing that they used to keep Jesse under control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Todd was, I thought, a very fun character. And Todd also loves easy listening. Was that a new fact that got brought up in El Camino, or did we get any of that in Breaking Bad?
I think, say that again. I'm sorry. I'm confused.
He loves 70s FM radio.
Yeah. What I was thinking about when you said that is, I was trying to figure out as far as Vince Gilligan goes, obviously, sound cues like that are very key. I don't remember Todd specifically loved them. It's very in keeping with Breaking Bad, is what I was thinking. Like, it's very in keeping with the style of the show to do something like this. As far as the character himself, not that I remember, but the show itself fits completely.
Okay. As we're talking about some of the flashbacks, the Walter White scene, I thought was really fun. So nice to see, you know, Walter and Jesse back together. And it wasn't like crazy Heisenberg Walt.
It wasn't crazy Heisenberg Walt, because this was season two, as we talked about. This was 4 days out. This was when Walt was still concerned with making just enough money to take care of his family. And he was convinced, I think, at that point, and you see the coughing going on here, I think he was convinced that he was going to die soon. This was before, I think, his cancer went into remission a little bit, and before he thought he could be a superhero, and before he became a super criminal. We see in the scene, of course, he's talking about, how long do you think it'll take to sell this? And the question is open-ended, because I think he's wondering if he's going to live long enough to see return on this money. And Jesse basically says to him, like, your family will be taken care of. He understands Walter's concerns. So no, this is the guy who will become Heisenberg, and he's certainly the genius that can make the meth and can come up with all these things, but they're still cooking in the Winnebago at this point. So this is not super lab, super criminal Heisenberg even. But you know, even in the context of this season, the season where this scene would have taken place, he does some horrible things. So Walter White was never a great guy in the context of Breaking Bad. He was always ready, I think, to do this and emerge from this cocoon as this evil person.
Why was this moment important to Jesse?
In terms of remembering it, as far as a flashback goes, That's a good question. It showed, I think, a moment when they were both considering maybe getting out of the game, when they looked back on a moment. It's also, I think, one of the more tender moments between Walt and Jesse as far as that goes, that Walt is actually showing a little interest in what he might do. I think if you're talking about a Jesse Pinkman who's contemplating his future and what actions he may take, Walter was such an influential figure in his life. And for him to remember that Walter said he would be really good at business and marketing, that's probably something that Jesse does think about a lot. Like, this is a big compliment I got from Mr. White. Even though he didn't remember that I graduated from high school, he wanted me to go to college. He thought I would be good at this thing. As I'm thinking about my future, this is probably the sort of thing I remember. As far as the show Breaking Bad goes, those are some of the happiest times for Jesse. That's when Jane was in his life. That's who he's calling on the phone from the hotel. He's doing really well. The heat's not really on them. There don't seem to be any real obstacles to them. And Walter is showing some interest in him as a person and giving him a compliment there. So I can understand why he would remember that for sure, especially in this moment.
So if you had to speculate what's Jesse going to do in Alaska, what would you guess?
I mean, look, some shows end when people go and become loggers and they're terrible. Yeah. I'm not making reference to any Showtime shows, but we don't want to talk about becoming a lumberjack. I don't think Jesse would become a lumberjack. I think Jesse probably gets a little house together, builds a cabin, buckles down for the winter. I think he probably reads a lot more. And as far as businesses go, he probably finds some way. Maybe he takes a note from Robert Forrester and sets up Alaska's best vacuum store. Or maybe he does get into some higher level business and marketing. Maybe he becomes a marketer for the Alaska Tourism Board, showing why it would be nice for people to come to Alaska or move to Alaska. He wouldn't want something very high profile, you wouldn't think,
no.
Right? Like, yeah, this is the problem with what happens with Gene. Gene keeps a very low profile in Better Call Saul. He's at a Cinnabon at a mall. You think kind of that kind of thing seems insignificant, but even that seems too much for Gene. So what can Jesse do? I mean, he's got to basically, I think it's somewhere between the way Walter was living when he fled to New Hampshire and Gene, somewhere between those two things. I think he's going to live a pretty solitary existence, but I do think he's going to want to be involved. He wants to be a big brother, I think. Like, I really do think he wants to be a positive male influence in someone's life. So I can foresee him doing something like that. Do you think we'll revisit this? Do you think we'll get another El Camino movie where we see how Jesse is living in Alaska?
I don't think so. I think that the origin story for this is, I think that they felt like that they ended up giving Aaron Paul short shrift in the ending of Breaking Bad. And I think that this was kind of like a make good for Aaron Paul of how the final season and the final episodes really focus so much on Walter White. And I just think that they wanted to, you know, do something for him and tell, whether it was Aaron Paul himself or Vince Gilligan feeling like an obligation to the character. I felt like that they wanted to sort of like balance things out. And I think they're good now.
I agree. And I don't think we need to see more of it. I think they're showing from Better Call Saul, I think there are more stories to tell in the Breaking Bad universe. We can't do a Mike flashback movie. I don't think we can flashback to the 70s unless we're recasting Jonathan Banks.
Yeah. What about a Todd origin story like the Joker that we'll see? How did Todd become this way?
Yeah, that's great. With Joaquin Phoenix as Todd, that would be dope. They're directed by Todd Phillips. He works even more. I don't know if we necessarily want that, a Todd origin story. Mm-hmm. We could, I think, as we're seeing on Better Call Saul, there is a lot to be mined out in terms of the Gus Fring story. And I still think, in keeping with Narcos, a great successful show on Netflix, I do think there's a possibility of telling a young Gus Fring story, what it was like to grow up in Chile. What it was like when he moved, how did he first get involved in some of the things he got involved in? Is that a movie length thing? Is it an episode length thing? I think we could do that, and we could probably do it in the way we did El Camino. But I don't know that we would want flash forwards into the Breaking Bad universe. So I don't know how we situate that movie, but I think if you're going to talk about other things to revisit or visit deeper in Breaking Bad. That's one big way to do it is Fring. And I think the question becomes, how much of that are they going to do on Better Call Saul? Do they even know that yet? And so maybe we get to the 15th anniversary of Breaking Bad when Better Call Saul's end game is more clear. This was done for the 10th anniversary. So maybe we get to the 15th and we say, okay, we know now what Better Call Saul did with Fring. Here's how we can fill in those blanks. And so maybe they do that. That's about all I could really see. I don't see another one like this. And I think you're definitely correct in saying this was to service the Jesse Pinkman character. He got a little bit of a short shrift. There are people that are worried that it didn't end well for him. Rob, even when we podcasted about the end of Breaking Bad, I remember us talking about how it probably did not end well for Jesse Pinkman. He was coming out of there insane. He would have been the most wanted man in the entire area. He didn't have any money. He didn't have any real ability that we could think of to get out of town. Mm-hmm. So we thought, just speculating, that it didn't end well for him. And I think what we saw is he had to go through a lot of hoops to get out of town, for sure.
Yeah. The Jesse Pinkman ending ended up being too open-ended. So El Camino ends up putting that question to rest.
Correct. And that's good. I mean, it's good. And like I said, my concern was they were going to put it to rest in a much more negative or upsetting way. The fact that they put it to rest and he ended up with the same ending that most people he ended up with, I think that makes people feel like, do we really need this? And I think the answer to that is no. But does that mean you don't enjoy it? Like, does that mean you don't want to watch it? Does that mean you didn't have fun revisiting one of your favorite shows? I think most people will enjoy this, even if the need for the show wasn't really great. I still think it's important that we put a bow on the Jesse Pinkman character in the way that we did. And I don't think this did any real damage to the show at all. So I don't see any real harm in it. And I enjoyed watching it. So here we are.
So we got some updates on a few different characters. We heard about Lydia in a news report. Sounds like Lydia was not going to make it, Antonio.
It sounds like Lydia was not going to make it, which I think is interesting, right? That they didn't affirmatively say that she definitely didn't make it. That's something, if I were to speculate on, I would say, well, why didn't she just die? Like, why leave that open? And I don't, maybe they left it open because whatever Walter gave her instead of stevia wouldn't have killed her that quickly. That was something I think that was talked about a little bit, how that would progress. But I think they probably could have found a way to make that clear, put a button on that, and kill her if they wanted to do so. The fact that they didn't do that does make me wonder if they're at least open to leaving that door open. Maybe, again, for the Gene universe, the Better Call Saul universe, maybe there's something there. Not as clear, or probably not as muddy, I should say. Very clear, something people speculated about a ton, whether Walter White was going to make it or whether he had ultimately died at the end of Breaking Bad. I think made very clear here, Rob, Walter White is dead. You're on board with that. And I'm sure.
I didn't even know that this is an open question.
Unfortunately, yes. People will speculate upon anything, I think, these days.
Yeah. I mean, Walter White is definitely dead. It's not like a Tony Soprano thing.
I blame podcasts for this, Rob. People want to theorize about every element of everything. Yeah, Walter White is dead. Not a Tony Soprano thing. He's dead. There's no way to revisit Walter White in the Breaking Bad universe unless we do flashbacks. He's gone.
Were you surprised that we didn't get any updates on Skyler or Walt Jr., like anything, not even like a news report with any of them?
It is a little bit surprising, right? There was some level, I think, where Walter White being outed as Heisenberg had already happened in the context of Breaking Bad. If you remember, there's the scene where he goes back to town in the middle of season 5, and he goes back to his house, and kids are treating the pool as like a skateboard ramp, and someone has spray painted Heisenberg at his house. And Skyler later in the series is in hiding and just trying to live like a nondescript life. So that some of that has boomeranged back already, but it is a little odd that we didn't get any mention at all, or they didn't find a way to work that in. Maybe they felt it would have been a little too ham-handed to put that in. Maybe they're right about that. But yeah, it was a little surprising. It just didn't, I guess, fit with what they were doing.
When you go see Robert Forster and he's going to make you disappear, you get to pick where you want to go. Like, I kind of feel like that he would probably like, I feel like he would give you options. Like, you tell him Alaska and then he then like figures everything else out.
That's what it seems like, right? Because we know, I think we know where Gene wanted to end up. And that's sort of, he got, not only did he end up kind of where he wanted to end up, but he ended up doing what he wanted to do. So there does seem to be Robert Forster. Maybe he gets you a new identity in terms of a social security number, and it will trace on paper. He works with you to ensure that you're going to keep up with that new identity, and he makes that happen. And then he helps you facilitate your clean landing wherever you go. And then he's out of the picture. You don't go back to him if you're Gene, if you're Jimmy McGill, and say, what can I do? The exception to this seemed to be Walter White. Like, he was driving to New Hampshire and talking to Walter White and continuing to serve as a conduit for him. If I recall from Breaking Bad, that was seen as a special job by Robert Forster, and Walter was paying a very high price for those services. So it seems to be that he'll do whatever you sort of ask him to do, but you have to be, he has rules, obviously, as we saw play out in this. The man lives by a code. You can't say that for this vacuum cleaner salesman. He's very specific about what he wants from you.
Just because Arizona to Alaska, while alphabetically they may be close, that's a hike.
It is, and he made the trip with Jesse. Yeah,
yeah.
So
which involves cutting through Canada
and putting his own like border crossings on a list somewhere, right? Like, it's a little easier to explain why a vacuum cleaner salesman has vacuums and has a business. It's a little harder to explain why he's crossing the border randomly and making these cross-country trips a lot. He had a U-Haul full of stuff there, so maybe he was like, I'm going to buy some Canadian vacuum cleaners. That's all there is to it. They've got the best Hoovers up here in Alaska. I mean, I don't know. It is a bit of a risk. Seems like he's sticking his neck out a little bit.
I mean, how long was Jesse living in the little crevice? I mean, that's got to be probably almost as bad as when he was in the cage at Todd's house.
That's what I thought. I was watching this, like, oh my God, you put this guy back into an enclosed space, and granted, he looks like Justin Timberlake, Man of the Woods. When he emerges, he's got a, like, nice turtleneck sweater and a coat on. But this does not seem to be, and he had like a space heater in that tiny space. Like, yeah, this just seems like
like a coffin. Right.
Yeah. 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 And he'd been there for at least as long as it takes to drive from New Mexico to the Canada-Alaska border. So it was certainly a while. Maybe he got out to rest at time, but maybe that was just to hide from the border crossing. But again, it doesn't seem like Robert Forster stopped after they crossed the border. I guess maybe they just finished crossing the border. So maybe that's what it was. Once they got back into the States, he let Jesse out right away.
Yeah. And what was wrong with Canada? Why did Jesse have to go all the way to Alaska?
Maybe Robert Forster can't facilitate all those documents.
Oh, like maybe
he can only do U.S. stuff. US Who documents. Knows?
Okay, that's interesting.
Maybe Jesse hates Justin Trudeau. Maybe that's the other thing.
Yeah, but you got to remember the 2008 of it all, where if he was a prominent, I guess I know he is the son of a former prime minister, so I guess he might have some awareness of him. But
yeah, he was still in brownface then, I think.
I don't know. That was canon in this universe. Did you notice anything where it was 2008?
I didn't. It's weird because Breaking Bad, it's hard to, you know, keep all the timelines and the years in your head. So nothing really jumped out to me as being like a total anachronism or a representative of the time period. I watched for Badger and Skinny Pete, their chairs, the video games they were playing. They had a nice TV set up there, but nothing screamed like, okay, this is wrong.
Or, did they have the Captain Kirk bridge chair? Is that the chairs that they had?
It looked like it, right? Because it is established that they're big Star Trek fans, these guys. So that is Breaking Bad canon. So it did look like it was some modified form of that, which makes sense that that's what they would spend their money on. Speaking of their money, did you put together that the money that they gave Jesse was the money that Walter White would have just paid them to run the scam that he ran on Gretchen and the Gray Matter guy at their home?
Oh, definitely not. Yeah. I was like, boy, Skinny Pete and Badger are really like rolling in cash.
That's why. That was Walter White's money, right? Mm-hmm. So in an indirect way, Walter White did help Jesse with this escape because Walter White at the end of Breaking Bad, of course, he wants to try to come up with a way for his family to get his money. And one of the things he sees on TV when he's in New Hampshire that perhaps makes him return is he sees this element of the gray matter, the people that were in the business that he was in, that he had a big falling out with. He sees him on TV, angrily storms out of the bar where he is and just beats a tail right back to New Mexico. And when he gets there, he goes to their home and he's waiting for them. And he basically has these two guys. He says they're the best snipers mm-hmm. west of the Mississippi. And he says he has them train these like laser pointers on them. And it's sneaky. It's Skinny Pete and Badger that he pays to do this. And so they get a bunch of money from Walter to do that. That was theoretically like one or two nights before tops when all of this had happened, because Walter goes right from there into his grand plan against Jack and frees Jesse. Jesse drives away, ends up at Skinny Pete's house. Here we are. So that's Walter White's money for sure, I would say.
Wouldn't this have been a great opportunity to update us on the status of Huel? Did he ever get out of the hotel room?
If you go to the Breaking Bad Twitter account, one of the things they did for El Camino, which is, I think, probably sparked a lot of conversations in advance of the thing, and then probably in the afterwards, is so they released a couple scenes, one of which I know did not make it into El Camino. One of the trailers had Jesse Pinkman listening to the radio. I think it played a little bit differently than it did within the context of the movie, so I don't think it was the same thing. Another thing they released in advance was a scene where Skinny Pete was being questioned by the police mm-hmm. and basically saying, like, I don't know where he is. So you could imagine that scene would have taken place after the police showed up tracking the El Camino and took Skinny Pete in for questioning. But one of the things they have since released is a scene where they basically said, it's time. We have released El Camino. And it says, Huel has left the safe house and El Camino is now available. And if you play it, it's a 1 minute scene of Huel sitting in the safe house, and he basically just says, screw this, and he gets up and leaves.
Oh, okay. So yeah. Good. I'm glad.
They tied the bow around that.
Good. I'm glad.
Job well done.
Yeah. All right. There you go. Happy that we got that closure.
Yeah, I think that also speaks to them realizing, like, as far as the things they maybe left on the table or wanted to do at the end of Breaking Bad, this is their bite at the apple. So let's do them. Let's make a joke and have fun with showing Huel leaving the safe house. If there were other things that people were really worried about, they probably would have shown them some way, some form promoting this movie.
But is a scene that's on Twitter, on the Breaking Bad Twitter, is that canon?
I'd say this is, I want to believe this is canon, just because it's more Huel in our lives. I'm buying this as canon. It's very funny. You should definitely check it out. 408,000 views as of right now. Mm-hmm. So, hopefully everyone who watches El Camino watches that scene. But again, there's no, I mean, how would you know to go to the Breaking Bad Twitter account and watch that? So maybe it's not canon.
Okay. Robert Forster ends up turning down Jesse Pinkman because he's $1,800 short. Isn't this crazy?
It seemed crazy to me. I wondered what his game was. Like, I did not really think that he was holding out.
He's such a man of his word that, like, he can't, like, all right. I mean, that's like the sales tax on this.
Right. And I thought the car Jesse had surely was worth a couple $100. Like, I didn't understand how there was literally no negotiation in play here. But he just seems to be a man of very specific rules. It stands to reason on some level, because this is a guy who, in order to engage his services at all, you have to call his number and leave a very specific request for a very specific kind of vacuum. And if you don't do that, it doesn't happen. So he probably is a guy who lives by this code, so, and that's probably what's kept him out of the eyes of the law and makes him confident that he can just call the cops to show up at his business. So he is probably the kind of guy that lives by a code for that reason, and so no exceptions to that rule. Did you think when he started packing the money up and he said, I'm not going to take your money, did you think that the Robert Forster character was going to actually just say, you know what, this one's on the house, you were willing to pay me back, you were willing to give me every last dollar out of your pocket, I'm going to do this for you for free because I heard you were being kept a captive?
Yeah, it was a little confusing about the, like, no rain check policy also, where that, okay, well, you hired me this one time, and so you have to pay me for that one also. And then he says, like, give me the bag, you know. So, yeah, it wasn't exactly clear. He's a mysterious guy, Ed.
Definitely. He's a mysterious guy. He lives by a code. He lives very specifically with that code. And then in the context of that code, though, he's a true, like a good guy. Like he is, once you engage his services, he's not going to let you down. Mm-hmm. That is the good news for that.
Yeah. What about Ed's backstory? Do you want to see the Ed solo movie, the young Ed? How did he get into this business?
I mean, this is a sore subject because it's not, you know, we're going to have to recast it. But
we're going to see like the 30-year-old Ed.
That'd be pretty great, actually. If you're taking it back 40 years in the context of, I mean, they could do it. I don't, you know, part of what they do when they want to do something like this, and we see it on Better Call Saul all the time, is they love working with actors that they can work with again in the context of that universe. If they bring somebody in, we talk about this a ton on our Better Call Saul podcast. It's like, oh, that person was only in one scene, but they really like that guy. They're going to find a way to use that guy again. And you, sure enough, you'll see them pop up in other episodes of Better Call Saul. Rob, we saw a Better Call Saul character pop up in El Camino. The big guy who was the guard for the strippers is somebody that we've seen hilariously in Better Call Saul. There's a scene with Mike in the parking garage where Price, the goofy baseball card collector, has called a bunch of mercenaries to do a job for him. And Mike braces the dude who thinks he's a badass and carries like six guns with him. Mike basically like throat chops him and holds him down and takes all his guns off of him and throws him in the trash. And then the other guy in that scene is this big guy. And when he sees Mike do that, he takes one look and he runs away into the parking garage. So this could easily have been someone else from the Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul universe. They use this guy from Better Call Saul. So they like to do that. So I think the problem is if you did a 30 years ago Ed movie, I think you'd have a harder time bringing in people from the Breaking Bad universe like they like to do. I think there's less grist for them in doing that. So I think they're less interested. Now, do they want to find a way to use Dean Norris again, Rob, so we can talk about sex gifts? Sure, maybe. But I don't know if we want to go back 30 years.
Yeah, Dean Norris has been completely left out of all of these other Breaking Bad projects so far. That no Saul sightings. No, I mean, I think that he's probably the biggest character from the original series that has not been brought back on either El Camino or Better Call Saul.
Yeah, he hasn't. And I don't think it's because I don't like Dean Norris. I would assume that they're getting close to a point where they can start to work that into Better Call Saul. But it didn't make as much sense, I don't think, to work it into El Camino. Although, at the end of El Camino, I think a lot of people are speculating when it comes to El Camino. How did they find out about Jesse so fast? Like, how did they know it was him? So they're, you know, you see him driving away, and then basically like the next day, they're worried about Jesse Pinkman. Well, part of how they could have found out is Marie, you know, Hank's wife, would have remembered that Jesse Pinkman had worked with Hank. That was something that happened in Breaking Bad that she was aware of. They might have found his fingerprints there if they could fingerprint that quickly. There are probably people that would have connected him to Walter White along some of the way. So I do think all of that is possible. And I do think there is a possibility. It's a little surprising to me that Jesse doesn't feel a little more guilt over what happened to Hank, considering he was really the one that brought Hank into that story, and that Hank's ultimate demise came as a result of Jesse really upping the ante in trying to get the DEA against Walter White. So it's a little bit interesting to me that we didn't see Dean Norris in this in one of those flashbacks. And I can't really speculate as to why. Maybe he's busy. Maybe the guy's busy.
What do you think that Jesse said in the letter to Brock?
Hopefully he said, this is why your mother died. It wasn't your fault. It wasn't her fault. Mm-hmm. There's a horrible guy who wanted to exact revenge on somebody that your mother knew. And maybe also he said, hey, remember that time you got sick at school and nobody knew why? Like, I think it was because of this horrible man. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much Jesse knew about that at the end, but he definitely knew why Andrea died. And he definitely could have said to Brock, like,
kid went through
a lot. Here's some things. Yep. Kid went through a lot. And I think Robert Forrester read the letter in part to make sure Jesse wasn't writing anything in there that would have revealed Jesse's location, just to kind of look out for Jesse. But I do think that Jesse was probably writing to say, hey, I'm trying to help you here. Your mom was beautiful. She was a wonderful person. You may not remember that, but I want you to know it. And I want you to know it wasn't her fault that she died.
Yeah. Okay, Antonio, anything else you want to say about El Camino to start to wrap this up?
I really did like the old Joe, the guy who is the junkyard guy. He loved the magnets thing, and he was willing to help Jesse no questions
funny.
Asked.
Yeah. I thought that he was dead, that guy, but I think that I'm confused because he died on Friends. I think he was the naked,
he was the neighbor,
not the naked neighbor. He was like the guy that would always, come in and say they were making too much noise.
Right. So no, he did not die in Breaking Bad somehow. One of the few who lived.
Mr. Heckles.
The one who lived. He lived, and Jesse would. It would make sense that that's who Jesse would go to. Again, finding a way to use actors that you really like. It would make sense. Jesse would call this guy. He would recognize this guy, and ultimately, Jesse has brought a lot of business. Jesse and his partners have brought a lot of business to Old Joe. So it's not surprising they would call Old Joe and they would use him. It was really fun to see that guy show up. Also, really fun to see him run away. I laughed really hard at that. Other things, I really loved the overhead shot of the Todd's full apartment and how they were breaking that down. That looked really cool.
Yes. Better Call Saul, like one of these Mike Ehrmantraut montages. Somebody was saying to me on Twitter that Jesse was playing Hide the Veto.
Yeah, he was. He probably would have won as well, for that matter. I liked the shootout. I thought the shootout was good. We didn't talk a ton about these newer characters, the candy welding guys. They were, I think you find, if you look through Breaking Bad, Todd was gone. Uncle Jack was gone. The Nazis were gone. There weren't too many people who had wronged Jesse that were gone. So in the context of the narrative of a film structure, if you want to introduce a bad guy and you want to have Jesse have a showdown with the bad guy, and Breaking Bad's always been a little bit of a Western, I think it makes sense that you would introduce this character, have the showdown the way you did. I thought they did a pretty elegant job of tying him in to Jesse's story. When you're playing with the timelines, I thought, you know, I didn't rewatch Breaking Bad directly in advance of this, and I was like, what am I forgetting from Breaking Bad that this guy, a welder, would have done with Jesse? I thought that this guy helped dispose of Drew Sharp's body. I thought it was something like that. And so Jesse would have had a beef with him. I didn't realize that the Flash Jesse was seeing at that time was actually a Flash from the Breaking Bad timeline that we didn't see. So I thought they did a really good job bringing those characters into the mix. Have you been watching The Righteous Gemstones?
So I actually have watched the first two episodes of it recently.
Yeah, this guy has a role on The Righteous Gemstones. So I'm curious as to whether people that are fans of both were like, oh, what's that guy? I've seen that guy in everything now. He's like a poor man's Danny McBride. So it was fun to see that guy and to see those kind of villains play out. They were not super huge threats. I really overall liked how Jesse was able to show a little bit of his skills and his smarts. Walter, you know, never really gave him credit for that. Gus and Mike tried to fake their way into giving him some confidence. It was really cool to see that play out in the course of this movie. Sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. He was smart enough to recognize that they weren't cops. He was too stupid to recognize that Robert Forster would have called the cops. I just thought all of that playing together, it worked really, really well. And I thought Aaron Paul was excellent too. Just not enough credit I can give to the performance. I thought he played it really well. Maybe don't take a shower with your gun, but other than that, really good.
No, that's not ideal.
I'm not a gun owner, but as far as I know, that's probably not ideal.
I did think that the Hamilton-esque duel seemed odd. Like I didn't know that was a thing that somebody would propose. Like, all right, how about this? Let's duel. Like what?
Yeah, Jesse didn't even have a second there. That's not fair. Yeah, and where was the doctor nearby? So maybe not the most well set up duel in that regard, but 10 paces at dawn. I thought it worked really cool. It was shot in a way that felt like the kind of Western that Breaking Bad has always in some ways been a little bit. So I enjoyed that. And I enjoyed Jesse being using a trick there, using like a Han Solo or some kind of like gunfighter type trick where he had the gun in his pocket. I thought that was really clever. And I don't want to be shot by a 22, Rob. They're making jokes about that, but I don't want to be shot by a 22. Do you?
No, I mean, I don't want to be shot by anything.
Exactly. Yeah. So no thanks.
Yeah.
No thanks. Yeah.
I did like Todd's landlord. Nosy Lou, is that his name?
Yeah. Yeah. Was he even the, I was trying to figure out if he was even the landlord, if he was just like a shitty neighbor.
Yeah.
He might have been the landlord. He might have been a neighbor. He might have just been a ghost. Like, I'm not sure he was real. I wondered on some level at some point, I was like, is this guy going to end up being secretly violent? Like,
no.
Is he going to be the one that rescues Jesse somehow? Is he going to brain these guys? Like, where does this end? And at the end, he's just a goofball. So that was pretty funny.
Yeah. He had one line when the other fake cop was trying to talk to him. And when he's filling up the tea kettle and he says, since I got the Brita, the tea tastes noticeably better. just really, that tickled me. And I really liked it when Badger was Badger and Skinny Pete were trying to give Jesse some cologne options. And Badger, I think, says to him, obsession is the bomb, yo.
Yeah, and Skinny Pete's like, I got him that for Christmas. That is one thing I'd like to see. I would like to see the Badger and Skinny Pete Christmas special of Breaking Bad, just to see those guys celebrate the holiday,
yeah.
Kick them back. Yeah, let's get there. Let's have that.
Yeah, so all in all, I feel like that there were fun moments to be had by these characters. I did feel like a little too much of the torture porn for me. I wasn't loving all of that.
There was the one scene where the goofy neighbor landlord guy was coming down the hall watering the ficuses, and Jesse was trying to get in the door and drop the keys and fumbling with the key, and the police line tape wasn't getting put back, and I don't need this. I don't, this is why.
Too much anxiety.
This is why I enjoyed watching the Downton Abbey movie more on the first view, because the stakes were so low and I wasn't going to be upset that they were going to ruin something or take something off the board in a way that upset me. They did that in Breaking Bad, and there was a little torture porn. So I agree, especially the arachnid. Yeah, no bueno.
I didn't know you were such a big Downton Abbey
guy. Oh, I love Downton Abbey. Yeah, I'm the Earl of fucking Grantham, baby. Oh, sorry for the F-bomb.
Yeah.
I mean, just like the regular Earl, I'm out here swearing.
What did they do in the Downton Abbey movie?
They had a royal visit to Downton Abbey.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to spoil any real details, but that set up the premise for the rest of the movie, how everyone was responding to that, what everyone was trying to do in response to that, the excitement over that, how the servants were preparing for it, what they were doing was like the biggest moment of their lives, and the just how it represented everything that was happening at the time period and for the characters really well. It was just really enjoyable. Mostly they played a lot for laughs, and I think they succeeded. I saw it in theater, and I saw it on a Tuesday, like half price night.
It was in the theater.
It made a lot of money, Rob.
What?
Like, if you go look, it made dozens of millions of dollars. It made a lot of money for a movie like this. And the audience, I was the youngest person by 10 or 15 years.
Yeah.
And there was, I mean, it was like, I think people were bringing in wine in like boxes and just like passing
it
out. When the movie opened, I heard like a Coke can open, and I'm like, this movie theater doesn't have like canned beverages. What is this? And like, as I was walking out, I looked down, it was a can of wine someone had brought.
Nice.
It's like, yeah, Downton Abbey, living it up, the Downton Abbey life. Yeah, I'm a big fan.
That's pretty wild. All right, so maybe this is going to be a thing where more and more TV show franchises are going to come back and they're going to do a movie.
It's a lot easier. Look, we live in the reboot world, right?
Yeah.
Where shows get rebooted or brought back for like 24 or Heroes or however you want to do these shows that were popular. They get rebooted or reborn. Sam Esmail, the guy who is the incredible creative voice and the director of Mr. Robot, is going to be taking on Battlestar Galactica for NBC's new streaming service. Like, this is a thing that people do now. These things, just everything old is new again. So I think a way to do that without necessarily damaging your product significantly is to make a movie. The Downton Abbey movie, for example, Rob, had a $13 to $20 million estimated budget. And according to what I'm looking at, it has made $135 million in the theaters at the box office. There's no way they don't make three or four more Downton Abbey movies. And there's no way that being that successful worldwide doesn't lead to other products like that or like Breaking Bad, making a movie instead of making an additional series. I just think it's easier from a scheduling standpoint. It's easier from a story standpoint. It just makes a lot of sense. Are there shows that you would like to see, Rob, that have finished that you think a movie would serve or that would be good? Do you want the Lost movie? Is that something you think would be better than rebooting the show?
Well, what do you do after, like, you're just going to follow the people that got off the island? I feel like when there's a great idea to do it, I'd like to see more stuff like this, but I feel like that off the top of my head, I can't think of one that's like the no brainer that hasn't been done.
What about a Seinfeld movie? Like, what
well,
about
they kind of did that with the Curb Enthusiasm season. So, right. Yeah, I can't think of it off the top of my head.
It, I mean, you could do a Cheers movie. I feel like, there may be a way to do that.
You didn't watch the Goldbergs this week?
I did not. I had no idea this was in the zeitgeist. Is that something the Goldbergs did?
Yeah, I think there was a Cheers reunion on the Goldbergs this week.
Well, I did not know this. Now I have to watch. I do want to see
a lot
that,
of people
actually.
Are looking, very Todd-ish, on the, Cheers from the Cheers cast.
This is my not surprised face. Yeah, Ted Danson still looks like Ted Danson from The Good Place, but Parks and Rec's a good example. I'd love to see a Parks and Rec movie.
Yeah, well,
I'd
too
love
bad
to see them revisit.
I don't know if you could afford the budget.
Maybe not. Yeah, Chris Pratt, top lining that would be huge. And some of the people involved have been canceled. Maybe they're not canceled anymore. I don't know.
It's borderline. Yeah.
Borderline, one of those borderline cases. But I think sitcoms probably, I mean, didn't they make a Veronica Mars movie? Isn't that something they did?
I think that was like a Kickstarter that they did. Yeah. So I think it was made, and I think it was ended up being like fan funded.
I think there are ways for these popular shows to do that. And I think it probably makes sense for big shows when there may be a couple of loose ends that they would have liked to have tied up. The thing about Lost, and I brought it up, I know there's a few actual scenes that they released as sort of an epilogue, that they've done a little bit of this, where they've talked about this is what happens after the show. Not like the J.K. Rowling continually writing Harry Potter's epilogue for the last two decades, but like where they just released a few scenes. And I think there are ways that they could have, similar to this. I think this provides a pretty decent blueprint for how a show with a definitive ending can revisit their existing show with scenes from the timeline of the show as flashbacks and scenes that take place after the show to wrap up some element of the story that you didn't wrap up. So I do think there's that ability. With Downton Abbey, some of the characters are young, and that's a story that takes place in like the 20s and 30s. They could tell those stories for the next 10, 15, 20 years with just some of the characters aging up into key roles. So every franchise and every property is different, but I think that
you'd be there with the canned wine ready to go.
Exactly. I'm lining up opening night, baby. Get me there.
Okay. All right, Antonio, very fun to catch up and talk about some El Camino today. I know that what a busy weekend for you on the podcasting front, because I just was listening to you on the RJP B&B Talking Survivor with Mike and Liana.
That was a lot of fun. Talking Survivor and Twitter and conspiracies.
Yeah.
Everyone's favorite subjects.
That's become like a whole niche for you now.
What an accidental unintended niche. Oh boy. I'm going to have to evaluate some life choices here, but yeah, this is, I guess people enjoy it. So here I am.
Yeah. And then, yeah, by the way, you know, come for the survivors, stay for the, things you need to know about your Twitter account with Antonio.
Exactly.
On, this week's, Survivor B&B. Then you have, Mr. Robot coming up, later on tonight, or on Sunday. That's going to be, Mr. Robot. And then, what else are you working on with Josh Wiggler for Watchmen?
Yeah, Josh and I are going to be talking about Watchmen week to week over at his podcast, series regular for The Hollywood Reporter. It's really an honor that he would want me to participate with him on that podcast there. It won't be like the deep dives we do here at Post Show Recaps, where we really go, you know, for a 40-minute episode, we go almost 2 hours for each episode. But it will be a lot of us talking about a show from a creator, Damon Lindelof, who we love and admire. We talked about The Leftovers here at Post Show Recaps. We loved that show. We loved podcasting about it. It makes sense that we want to visit Watchmen. Where are you on Watchmen, Rob? Have you read or seen any Watchmen stuff in the past?
I saw the movie.
Oh boy.
The movie was bad?
It was only okay.
Okay.
It could have been worse. It could have been worse. It certainly could have been better. But is it something you're looking forward to as a show? I know you like to watch the HBO shows generally.
Yeah, I think I would definitely be interested in checking it out. I feel like that I don't know too much about the show, but I definitely feel like it sounds like it's going to be big. I don't know.
It could be.
FOMO.
It could be. Yeah, it could be. You don't want FOMO over Watchmen. You don't want Watch FOMO. So definitely check that out if you're interested. And it's something where if you've never read the Watchmen graphic novel, it's considered to be one of the 100 best novels, not just graphic novels, in American literature, or sorry, just I think in literature in general. I'm not even sure if it would qualify as American. I don't think it would. But it's worth checking out that. And HBO show is going to be in the world of that, but also not like a restatement of that. That stuff takes place in like the 80s. The show, I believe, is taking place present day. So it's assuming that the events of that novel have happened and how society has sort of responded in response to the events from the 80s. And I think it's going to have a lot to say about who we are as a society currently, commenting upon our times in a way that reflects and refracts, I think, who we are as a society. So definitely looking forward to that. What are you, Rob? This is your high season. You're in the midst of your Survivor blitz, and this is like, I feel like you're like an NFL player. You get on the grind once Survivor starts, and it's just a wash, rinse, repeat, where you're just on a grind all week.
It's a very regular schedule during Survivor. So we have everything going on with Survivor. Then we're doing our live show in New York this week, so I'm going to be heading out of town a couple days from now to do that as well. So very, very busy season.
Hell yeah, that'll be fun. Those are always a real blast, and it's a fun season Survivor to certainly watch play out. I think getting a lot of laughs out of some of this stuff we're seeing on screen. So maybe not everyone's favorite strategy stuff, but definitely a fun season to watch play out so far.
Okay, all right. With that, we had a email that Johnny D. Silvera could not let a episode of a...
We tricked him into watching Breaking Bad, so here we are.
Yes, okay. I would be very disappointed to not end up asking at least a Johnny D. Silvera question. Let's see. He said, when did you two know that they weren't cops?
Instantly, for me, instantly. I instantly knew these guys aren't cops. When they said, like, oh man, they really, really tossed this place over and they put their gloves on, I was like, these guys aren't cops. Like, they have no, equipment. They have no real reason to be here. These guys are not police. How about you? Was it when he said lieutenant?
No, I didn't catch it the first time, but the second time I was watching it, it was funny that knowing that they weren't cops when then the one guy calls out to the other guy when Jesse has him at gunpoint, like a lieutenant, like something must be up. Why is he pretending I'm a cop here?
Right, exactly. Like a clear message to the other guy. I'm not a cop. I did not. You say the torture porn. They tied him up. They were gagging. I didn't need any of that. I am thrilled with how that played out. And Jesse used a little bit of influence and kind of alphaed that guy into submission. But that was an excruciating scene before that, for sure.
Okay. All right. Antonio is on social media. Antonio, where should people follow you?
Twitter is where I reside mainly in social media wise. I'm at AC Mazzaro with two Z's and one R. And you can follow me there if you have any thoughts about any of these shows or any shows you think we should cover things. I mean, part of why I wanted to do this podcast with you, Rob, besides liking talking about this particular show with you, is it seemed like people wanted to hear it. So if there are things you want us to podcast about or you think we should comment on, let us know. Tweet at us.
Okay. All right. And then, of course, if you want to keep up with everything we talked about on post-show recaps, head on over to postshowrecaps.com/iTunes for our main post-show recaps feed. Thank you guys so much for listening. Take care, everybody. Have a good one. Bye.